right, folks, coming up on This Week in Law, we've got Anupam Chander, Nicholas Kristen, Kevin Thompson, and me, and we're going to fly our flappy bird right across a whole bunch of stories about the NSA and surveillance, and antitrust and Time Warner and Comcast. We've got a lot of hacking going on this week. Join us if you want to be safe next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 246, recorded February 14th, 2014. Are there mushrooms? Hello, you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host, and we have an incredible panel of folks today to help us understand, process, unpack all the latest developments and some very important developments at the intersection of law and technology. Those developments affect us all. We're very blessed every week to have such smart people come on the show and give us their opinions and insights on these kinds of issues. And this week is no exception. Joining us from the Davis McGrath firm in Chicago and Cyber Law Central, his great site, is Kevin Thompson. Welcome back to the show, Kevin.
Thanks, Denise. It's nice to be back. And happy Valentine's Day.
Yes, happy Valentine's to you. IRC is already suggesting that we call this episode of This Week in Law, This Week in Love. So if you guys are feeling romantic, you know, feel free. It's in the air today. All right. Also joining us as we dispense with some of the silliness is Nicholas Kristen from Carnegie Mellon University. Where he is an assistant research professor on information systems and security. Hello, Nicholas.
Hi, thank you for having me.
That was my mulligan for the day, Carnegie Mellon. So let's hope I don't need another one. Also from UC Davis here in sunny and dry California is the author of The Electronic Silk Road, Anupam Chander. Hello, Anupam.
Thank you for having me on, Denise.
Thank you for joining us. Anupam is also a professor at UC Davis, the director of the California International Law Center, and his research focuses on regulation of globalization and digitization. That's quite a topic, quite a research nut to crack there.
Everything in the world, really.
Yes, exactly. Hard to avoid anything under that rubric. All right, so it seems to me like almost everything in the news these days has some sort of privacy overtone. So let's start there and try and begin to understand what's going on. Anupam, let's talk a bit about your book and how the internet is a silk road between the various nations of the world that has never existed in this way before. First, you know, give us, for those of our audience members who haven't had the pleasure of reading your book yet, give us the overview and your basic premise.
Sure. Well, the ancient silk roads connected civilizations. So they were these incredible passages across, thousands of miles or kilometers. They really superpowered kind of technology transfer during their time, and they enabled people to access the best of the world, essentially the world of their time. And so, of course, that's the internet today. That's what the internet makes possible. But where the ancient Silk Roads focused on goods, the new Silk Roads are focusing on information. So where it was goods before, it's now the sale of services or the offering of services. So we have incredible riches that are available to the world through this kind of information transfer that the internet makes possible.
So when we're transferring information around, of course, the question of the sensitivity of that information and the importance of it to individuals and businesses, the importance of its confidentiality, perhaps, comes into play each and every time something is transferred on this electronic Silk Road or stored at some particular node upon it. So, of course, for months now, we've been watching the story and the fallout from the story on NSA surveillance unfold. Can you explain to us, Anupam, how the question of surveillance and security of information impacts the Silk Road?
So one of the things I do in the book is compare various parts of this new Silk Road. So I compare the United States and Silicon Valley in particular with India and its and Bangalore and various hubs for electronic services, electronically mediated services. And I compare also China, the kind of heart of the ancient Silk Roads. And so what I do is note that with respect to India and China, they both have an incredible array of talented people who could have offered services to the world. And in fact, you may have better infrastructure in China in a variety of ways. But it was India that became a champion in services rather than China. And my suggestion is that the Great Firewall of China is part of China's problem in this way, that the firewall of China created these interruptions to data flow across borders, interruptions that couldn't be tolerated in a kind of very highly fast-paced data processed world. But furthermore, that people would be reluctant, and Denise, you put it well, that data flows have all these implications about privacy. People would be reluctant, generally, to transfer en masse data to a country that where the government has few limits on domestic surveillance. So that the Great Firewall of China, I suggest, became a way not only to keep American companies out, but to keep Chinese companies in.
Got it. Okay, so in our own country here, of interest both to those not residing in the United States and those residing here who find their own information swept up in the surveillance of non-U.S. citizens, that we definitely have people up in arms in a way that we've seldom seen as far as protest over government action. We now have a U.S. Senator, Senator Rand Paul, who this week filed a class action, you know, among the various other lawsuits that are pending over NSA surveillance. The, you know, lawsuit of the week on this has been filed by Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, working together with conservative advocacy group FreedomWorks, pending in district court in the D.C. Circuit. And suing the president, the NSA, Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, Keith Alexander of the NSA, FBI Director James Comey, among others, and alleging that literally hundreds of millions of class members may be impacted by this lawsuit. Because of the scope of NSA data collection. I bring this up, obviously, there are many legal and constitutional challenges. This one appears focused on the Fourth Amendment. Others have taken the First Amendment approach to challenging the surveillance programs in the United States. I'm wondering if anybody, and we'll start with you, Nicholas, thinks that this lawsuit has a better chance than any of the others that are pending in actually achieving some kind of reining in of the surveillance in question?
It's a good question. It's very hard to answer because, well, so I'm a technologist, so I'm not necessarily able to judge the merits of the legal aspects of the lawsuit. What's interesting here is that you have an actual senator, so somebody with a certain clout, who is actually actively engaged in this. What is very interesting from a technological standpoint is that it's almost impossible to differentiate between U.S. and non-U.S. traffic on the internet. First of all, you have to define what is U.S. traffic. And I'm actually myself a good example of that. Am I a U.S. person because I'm residing in the United States? Am I not because my citizenship is different? There's a lot of questions. The framework is not very well defined. And even if it were, at a technological level, it's not like bits that are circulating on the internet have, you know, they are not carrying a little flag that says I'm a U.S. bit or I'm a French bit or I'm a German bit. And so whenever you're looking at surveillance on a large scale, it's going to be almost impossible to make sure that you're not collecting data from people you shouldn't be collecting data from. So in that respect, I think that some of the arguments that have been raised by the various people involved in those lawsuits, from a technological standpoint, they do have some merit. Whether or not it's going to be successful, I guess we'll have to see.
Anupam, I think that is a really excellent point and raises some issues right in your sweet spot as our scholar today on issues of international law, that of course it's not just U.S. citizens who have an interest in this lawsuit, but since the NSA programs are directed towards non-U.S. citizens, certainly those individuals have an interest in as well, although perhaps no opportunity or legal basis, you know, grounded in international law to have a say in how much they are surveilled by the U.S. government. Can you kind of unpack for us where things might stand, both for those in the U.S. where we can look to our Constitution to challenge these things, and for those outside the U.S. who aren't governed by our Constitution?
So Nicholas is in a good position, actually. He's sitting in Pennsylvania, where he is, despite being a French citizen, he is protected by the Fourth Amendment quite fully. However, if Nicholas were back home in France, the defense that under the Fourth Amendment would not readily be available to him. And so that is a real problem. We don't, in our law, constrain our intelligence services when they are acting with respect to non-U.S. persons outside the United States. And I think that is a shame.
Could you expand on that a bit? I mean, I sort of see us, as you're talking about the Great Firewall of China and the various policies that are in place there for both Chinese nationals and people who live outside their country, that we seem to be rolling towards this state of affairs internationally where every country is spying on every other country. Wait a minute, have we been in that state of affairs for quite some time now? And you really have the only checks and balances are, you know, everybody's doing it to one another. Is there anything internationally that can or should be reining this in?
Sure. So I think that governments are going to have to rein themselves in largely here. It's going to be hard to come up with international treaties or even kind of silent agreements between allied states not to surveil each other. I think really it's going to be the onus of governments to say that they won't do it, to kind of tie their own hands. Now, of course, promises shared amongst each other are going to be important. But I think one crucial reason to tie our hands in this process is because what I said about China, where China becomes a kind of not an attractive place to place all your data because you don't trust what the government of China might do with that data, might be said of the United States. So essentially, if we believe that the information economy is crucial to our future, that our success as a people relies on the ability of American companies to maintain their leadership as internet services providers in the world, then I think we have to make sure to curtail what we're doing abroad. So I think we have a strong economic interest in stopping this kind of behavior.
So you're talking about people internationally voting with their feet and deciding we're not going to do business with U.S. companies anymore. It's just too dangerous, too hazardous if we care about our data. And maybe there will be a search engine out of Norway that promises security, doesn't reveal information unless in very extreme and limited circumstances to government inquiries. And we will flock in the millions and billions to do business with that search engine rather than, say, Google or Yahoo. Is that what you're seeing or you're envisioning playing out?
That is one approach that's being taken around the world. But if you reflect on it for just a second, you can see why that's not a tenable approach. Remember what I said about Nicholas. Nicholas is better protected being in the United States. And so by choosing an offshore service entirely, a Norwegian service that only serves Norwegians, for example, you are creating essentially a totally wonderful space for the American intelligence service to operate without any constraint whatsoever. And so in fact, you are increasing the likelihood of American no holds barred intelligence by choosing services offshore. Remember, it's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The only limitations are when it implicates U.S. persons. And so by moving to a Norwegian system, one that's likely not to be as well tested, as well capitalized as many other systems, you're actually likely increasing the vulnerability to American surveillance, not decreasing it.
Excellent point. Kevin, getting back to the Rand Paul lawsuit, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that or about some of the sort of infighting that seems to be going on and accusations that are flying around now about some of the lawyers involved. It seems that emails have leaked insinuating or perhaps demonstrating that one of the lawyers was sort of ousted from the lawsuit and wasn't included on the complaint, was not, you know, adequately a major player in the suit that he was told that he was going to be. You know, is this just lawyers kind of sniping at each other and distracting from the larger issues here?
Well, I think when lawyers are involved, there's always going to be egos, and you know, certain egos I think have been stepped on a little publicly in some of this. You know, that I think you know, that's always the case with you know, big name lawsuits. That's almost inevitable that something like that's going to happen. But here, I just think it's interesting. I mean, I don't really know the merits of this particular case versus some of the other, you know, cases that are pending. I haven't had a chance to really sit down and compare, you know, their particular cases. You know, here we have, you know, a conservative senator, you know, coming in with a conservative group that's complaining about policy, a government policy that, you know, started under the prior administration. So, you know, it certainly has been, you know, kept in place by the Obama administration, but it certainly wasn't initiated by them. You know, this, you know, so like the conservatives now are like surprised and shocked to discover that, you know, there's this NSA surveillance going on. But at the same time, it's also interesting. I mean, there's other senators that have had to have briefings on this, you know, like even other senators haven't been able to really find out what the NSA is actually doing. And they, you know, they're forced to, you know, turn to these third-party experts like Bruce Schneier and some of these others that are, you know, technologists that are, you know, actively studying like the Snowden documents and so forth, you know, just to see just what exactly the NSA is really doing. You know, senators don't really seem to know. So I think it's certainly a nice thing to see that people are starting to, you know, be concerned, and there's public awareness, you know, of this particular issue. I think one of our other articles dealt with, you know, the outcry from the general people. I think there was the day the internet cried out.
Well, the EFF on February 11th put up the day we fought back.
Right, that's what it was.
Information and activism site. It's not just EFF. It's a whole coalition of sites and organizations, including the ACLU and Reddit. And you can go check out thedaywefightback.org. And there are nice little tools for calling your representatives in Congress, emailing your legislators, and a bunch of information trying to rally grassroots support around this. In much the same way as we saw with SOPA and PIPA a while back. Kevin, do you think that apparently they say, let's see, how many folks did they get? I think I snippeted this. Yes, in one day, over 71,000 concerned Americans picked up the phone and told their congresspeople to rein in the NSA. Far more sent emails to their members of Congress. Around the world, over 200,000 put their name to a set of founding principles against suspicionless surveillance by the NSA, by their own governments, and by anyone who dares violate our human rights. So obviously, gentlemen, this doesn't have the force of law, but this sort of thing, as with SOPA and PIPA, can have an impact. Kevin, do you think this was a worthwhile thing for these organizations to do?
I think it certainly was. The more people that are involved, the more people that decide to call their Congress critter and otherwise cause awareness in Congress that this is an issue that they personally are concerned about, I think that's a great thing. I happen to know that there was even a small physical protest that came by our offices that day, close to 5 o'clock during rush hour. It was just a small protest, but it was still, you know, kind of nice to see, you know, that there were, you know, people that took to the streets to publicly raise awareness of, you know, the NSA and its activities.
Right. EFF said they had coverage on CNN and PBS and The Guardian, The Washington Post. So definitely a great way to bring attention to the issue. Nicholas, do you have any thoughts about what happens next as far as maintaining grassroots support?
Well, I think that the grassroots support from people who are, you know, supporting the EFF and other online organizations devoted to fighting for privacy, it's always been here. I mean, this isn't something that has started, you know, 2 weeks ago or even last summer. What is important, though, I think, is that in this specific case, this type of actions lead perhaps the mainstream, people who are not technologists, people who are not even necessarily very cognizant of the issues of online privacy, to actually see that this is an important question. Now, whether or not it's going to be effective, again, I mean, this is not something that I can assess right now. But I think that one thing that it may be useful for is, again, in terms of developing awareness. And when you have awareness, then you start to look perhaps at the technological solutions that you can use to at least make dragnet surveillance a little bit more difficult. And I'm talking about encryption. I'm talking about, you know, using anonymous networks and things of that nature. That they are not a panacea. I mean, they're not going to solve all of your problems, but they will make it harder for your traffic to be, you know, completely exposed.
Anupam, were there demonstrations on campus where you were?
You know, I didn't. At the law school, we're so busy, just basically learning the law that we aren't typically out in the streets. But I think there's reason to be out in the streets. So don't get me wrong. I was one of the people who called in yesterday. So I think many people in the audience, I mean, not maybe among the tech folk, but generally are kind of indifferent to this issue. They're thinking, you know, so what? The NSA has my data. Who cares? I don't care. You know, there's nothing. I'm not a terrorist, right? So I think it's actually quite worrisome. I think it's worrisome if we start assuming that the NSA has our data. Okay, so I think that itself is a problem. Why? Because if we then assume that the NSA has our data, we may be afraid to call someone and say something bad about the government. Now, you think that may sound ridiculous, but I want to bring a kind of real-world example here. And this is Governor Chris Christie these last few weeks and the response that he's had to the accusations against him. Now we have one of his former members of his staff, essentially. I'm sorry, the person that he appointed to the Port Authority, a very high-level person, essentially accusing Governor Christie of knowing everything about the bridge closure. And what Governor Christie did was turn around and accuse that person of being untrustworthy. Now, imagine if the governor had all the tools of the NSA and the NSA had all the data, okay? I think the governor might well have had many more kind of arrows in his quiver to use against this person who has complained about the governor. And so that's the worry that we might have. We would move essentially towards a kind of self-censored world where no one will say anything that might bring them within the where someone would never complain about the governor, knowing that that would mean the exposure of their secrets or of the secrets of their children or their loved ones. And so that's a world in which we can't live, right? That is 1984. Brought home.
And that sounds a bit like one of the arguments that might be asserted in one of the First Amendment challenges to NSA surveillance, which is going after the fact that if you're monitoring phone metadata, then you have access to people's associations and various other things that would be protected under the First Amendment. Or is it broader than that, Anupam?
I think it is actually truly a First Amendment issue, as you're describing. It's where people will no longer say something that they believe because they're worried about the consequences. They won't even say it, because of the electronic media. They won't say it on their social networks. They won't complain because they know that other people, they worry at least, that the government is listening and that the government will then, if it's annoyed with them in any way, come down hard on them by exposing their secrets. And every one of us has reason to worry. So we may not have done anything criminal, et cetera, right? But there are always things that people will not want exposed to the world, right? We don't publish our Gmail to the world. We don't publish our emails to the world. But imagine if that was the way you had to speak. Every email, every communication, every Facebook post was essentially one to the world. I think that would be a scary world. And I think that's one that we have to avoid creating.
It would. It would be scary and noisy at the same time. Let's go ahead and make fighting back our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're a lawyer or someone otherwise in possession of a bar card in a jurisdiction of the United States, you may well have to meet various minimum continuing legal education standards. We try and help you out with that. We've got a whole bunch of information over on the Twit Wiki at wiki.twit.tv. If you're listening to the show and hoping to get some MCLE credit out of hearing the wonderful insights of law professors such as Professor Chander with us today, then definitely go for it. Let us know how you're doing with that. Fighting back is our first phrase to be able to demonstrate if you need to some oversight authority that you actually listen to or watch the show. We'll put another one in the show a little later on. Let's move on from considering the information that the government is gathering and using in various ways to information that individuals are accessing and gathering that governments are frequently up in arms about. This has been a big couple of weeks for hacking. Let's start out with a story that I don't think necessarily even falls under the rubric of hacking, but does tie in with what Kevin was saying a moment ago about lawmakers and in this different case in France, judges and those determining legal disputes not being terribly up to speed on the technology that they're making decisions about. This was a really interesting incident involving a French blogger, activist, and businessman named Olivier Laurelli. What he did basically was liberate some information that was being stored online by the French National Agency for Food Safety, Environment, and Labor, with the acronym ANSES en français. And he stumbled on 7 gigabytes of internal documents from this agency simply by doing another Google search. He's a journalist. He runs a site called reflet.info, a community project to connect journalists and computer networking specialists, it is described as. And Olivier found this information, decided, well, this is not locked down in any way. I'm getting to it from a Google search. I'm not having to enter any passwords or credentials to access this information. And it's public information from a public agency. So instead of being a journalist himself, instead of simply pointing that out, that the information was available, or letting the agency know that, hey, you might want to protect this information a little bit better, he actually made copies of it. It resided on his server. And then he, in turn, published the information himself. That got him in trouble in court. There was a trial proceeding where the trial court concluded that since he hadn't actually done anything to circumvent security to access this information, that he couldn't be charged with criminal penalties. However, there was then an appeal. And the court on appeal just seemed to have a failing of understanding of what went on here. And he wound up getting charged the equivalent of $4,000 US fined that for his activities. Nicholas, did you look into this and can you give us your thoughts on it?
I saw the article and I read this news, and it was quite interesting. So apparently what the appeal court said was that yes, the information was publicly accessible and publicly available. It shouldn't have been, but it was through some misconfiguration of the server. But what what the person should have realized was that this was in a protected, well, supposedly protected network. And apparently because they kind of discovered that while they were looking for those, well, they weren't looking for those documents, but when they found them, they also saw that there was some sort of authentication service before that just wasn't working, wasn't doing anything. Because they were aware that this was probably supposed to be protected documents, then they were at fault for publishing them to the world, even though they were already there. I mean, Google had indexed them. So it's, to me, it's a little bit, you know, weird and interesting at the same time that this guy is being fined essentially for being perhaps indelicate, but at the same time, you know, this stuff was already online and essentially is, you know, in my mind, is paying for the incompetence of whoever is supposed to protect those documents at that agency.
That's right. It seems like he's being fined for his bad judgment here as opposed to any sort of criminal activity. Right. Perhaps, you know, as you said, it was indelicate of him not to let the agency know that this was a problem and instead just make it public himself. But the other thing that strikes me, and it's something we see happen over and over again, is that simply guessing a URL, or here stumbling on it in a Google search, gets equated with hacking. And part of the disconnect there is the fact that, you know, as Kevin was alluding to earlier, there's this, I think, sensation on the point on the part of the decision makers that something amiss happened here, but they don't really understand the technology. Do you agree with that, Kevin?
I think so. I think, like you say, this isn't the first case where someone has managed to figure out the URL, and you know, lo and behold, you know, there's information there at the end of it, and you can get to directories, you can, you know, get to the information that's there. You know, that's like, as Nicholas was pointing out, it's just a misconfigured server. But at the same time, it is accessible. And I think, you know, here the decision is what to do with that information once you have it. I know that like the people that had managed to guess the Apple user IDs for their developer service, I think that was part of that was a little bit of a, you know, they'd figured out the structure of that. Mm-hmm. That's a similar attack. You know, there's plenty of examples like this in the past, you know, where that this type of thing has happened. And, you know, for it to be classified as hacking, I think that's a bit of a stretch. It certainly is using the computer in a way that, you know, the people don't want you to do, but it isn't necessarily, it's pretty low on the list of hacking skills, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, I have trouble thinking of something like this as hacking at all. It's really more activism. Anna Palm, are you concerned about this as precedent, or do you think this was kind of a fluke?
So I think it's more than a fluke. I think the issue of accessing information, not through kind of breaking through some kind of protection schemes, but stumbling upon it and that leading to potential criminal liability is really problematic. I want to turn our attention to a domestic case. So in that case, this is a case involving Lori Drew that many people know about. There was an issue about bullying, and there was a girl who committed suicide, a very, very tragic case. But there was a prosecution for violating the computer fraud and abuse statute. And the prosecution argument went like this. She accessed essentially MySpace, accessed MySpace in violation of MySpace's terms of use. And therefore, they said she was a computer criminal. And I think we have to be very cautious about that. The district judge, a federal district judge, actually threw out the state jury verdict. So it all worked out okay under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But you can imagine kind of these interpretations of the law that really stretch to make anything that we might do online that troubles the proprietor of the website and goes beyond what they would have liked to be illegal and perhaps even criminal.
And of course, the Aaron Swartz case, had it ever made it to trial, would have involved similar kinds of issues. So it's not as though we don't struggle with that here in the U.S. as well, particularly under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as you mentioned, Anna Palm. Let's move on from someone who was not, it seems, engaged in criminality per se, but in wanting information to be free and wanting to alert the public to a situation that we've been discussing, to actual cybercrime and folks harvesting personal information, credit card information for fun and profit, as far as they're concerned. This is obviously getting worse as opposed to better, very much in the news the last few weeks with Target and Neiman Marcus and others being hacked and having data releases. You know, if they were oil rigs, we'd be out there trying to mop up. But it's very difficult to mop up credit card data once it's out there. Nicholas, can you give us your overview on what's been going on and sort of the state of affairs as far as credit card security goes these days?
Right. So what happened with Target was particularly bad because what got broken into is not, you know, some sort of database that is sitting in some remote server. What the people that were behind this managed to do is to actually install some malicious software, some malware, on the point of sales, meaning the cash registers. So basically, if you went to Target during the time the attack was going on and you swiped your credit card, basically, these people have all of the information that is on the card. And that actually suggests that our current payment system infrastructure or signature-based magnetic stripe-based cards may be, you know, a little bit obsolete to protect ourselves against this type of threats. And so there's been a push to actually move to things like chip and PIN, EMV type of cards, where instead of having just, you know, your typical plastic card with the magnetic stripe in the back, which you authenticate by signing a receipt, people have been saying that it could make sense to move to a chip and PIN standard where on the card itself, you've got a PIN, a chip, which is a little bit like what you have in the SIM card on your phone. It's basically the same technology. And that chip is able to perform very small computations, such as, for instance, verifying that you enter the correct PIN so that the PIN doesn't have to go to the register itself. But the only thing that goes to the register is, okay, this card is actually valid and the person who holds the card knows the PIN. If that had been deployed, then presumably the magnitude of the attack would have been a lot less. Now, this is not what we have in the US, and because of that, now there's about 40 million credit cards and debit cards information that is, you know, floating around. I don't know yet how many of those are floating in black markets. If I were one of the people who actually broke into those systems, I wouldn't open all 40 million cards right away. I would actually, you know, constrain the supply a little bit so that the price for those commodities in the black markets do not collapse. But the point is that you've got a ton of credit cards that are out there. Customers are not going to be that impacted in the sense that we have laws in the US that actually prevent people from being liable for most of the purchases made fraudulently by those credit cards. But it's going to be a mess. I mean, and it's going to take, as you said, quite a long time to clean up.
So let's talk about the changing technology, the chip and PIN strategy that people seem to think would be the solution to this. There are some credit cards in use in the U.S. that have chips on board, correct? I think I have one in my wallet right now.
Yes, but it's chip and signature. It's the proverbial it takes two to tango. Mm-hmm. If your card has a chip, but the place where you swipe it is not able to read that chip or to talk to that chip, then, you know, it's as if you didn't have anything. And most of the payment infrastructure in the US is based off technology that was developed in the 70s and early 80s that definitely did not support chips. And so that's where the real costs lie. If we want to upgrade our cards to chip and PIN, upgrading the cards is not that difficult, but you also have to upgrade the entire payment infrastructure so that they can talk to those chips. And right now, we just do not have that.
Is there a concern about RFID leaking if we have information stored in chips on the credit cards?
There could be. It really depends on how it's implemented. At that point, you know, it's... right now, there's no leak of information because there's mm-hmm. no chip, there's nothing.
Right.
Of course, you know, as it's being developed and as those solutions become to come to be implemented, I'm sure that people like myself will try to find ways of attacking those cards and seeing, you know, what kind of information we can actually access. But, you know, at least it would get the process going. And, you know, this is something that's been used in Europe for at least, I would say, a good 20 years now. We've had chip and PIN cards. Some of them have their own vulnerabilities. There's quite a lot of academic research that shows that chip and pin is not, you know, a perfect solution. But in this kind of game, you don't necessarily want a perfect solution. You want something that is a good enough defense so that the attacker does not really have any incentive, any economic incentive to actually try to breach your defenses. So the goal is not to have perfect security. The goal is to have security that is good enough that the bad guys prefer to do something else because it's not in their best interest to try to break into that system. And we're very far away from that at the moment.
Right. And it's being mandated, though, in the United States by the end of next year, isn't it?
I don't even know if it's going to be mandated. I mean, there's discussion that, yes, it should come by October of 2015 with potentially some interesting liability regime in as we are transitioning. But whether or not this is going to even happen or whether we are going to move to chip and signature, which is not very useful, I mean, all of this is up in the air.
I think the liability shift is an interesting thing for us to talk about. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal about the end of the swipe and sign credit card and this October 2015 date. I don't know if it's a deadline or a target for improving the security of credit card technology in the United States. And one of the notions is known as the liability shift. And as you know, if you're a credit card user, if you've been victim of credit card fraud, you basically get to call up your company and say, hey, it looks like there's unauthorized activity here, or maybe they're calling you and letting you know that, but you're off the hook. But who is on the hook and who will be on the hook under this liability shift doctrine is the person with the worst security. So the person in the chain of commerce, whether it's at the point of sale or the credit card company themselves, that will be the institution on the hook. And so the incentive would suggest the person, you know, we would have much better technology if everyone was trying to flee from that liability. Do you think that this is a good strategy, Anupam?
You know, I'm worried about major shifts like that. I don't have a view on the subject one way or the other, but it does strike me as worrisome that if we have major shifts in who has liability and then comparisons between who has a more or less secure a security system, I think that's going to lead to a lot of litigation. It's going to be good for my students and the lawyers in the audience. But I wonder if that's good for society at large. Now, I do think that we have a problem. I definitely think there's a problem. You know, when I traveled in Europe this last summer, Europe has this chip and pin system everywhere. In fact, I couldn't often use my American credit card. It was actually useless. And I had to make sure that I had pounds or euros on hand. Because I would have not been able to pay with a credit card. So I definitely think that we've got serious problems. I do worry when we have radical changes in the law, especially law of liability.
Nicholas, under chip and PIN, you would always have to enter your PIN on a keypad for every transaction?
If it's fully deployed, yes. But I think that we are so far away from that here in the States that you probably would have some sort of transition regime where there would be, you know, signature-based verification. And what would be really interesting is to see, you know, how liability is enforced then. It's, again, I mean, what I've seen seems good, but again, the devil is going to be in the details.
All right. Well, we'll have to continue watching that unfold. Kevin, any thoughts on credit card security?
I just had one question for Nicholas, though. I mean, I didn't see anything in the article that really addressed online retailers and how they would handle the chip and pin type system. How do the companies overseas, you know, who currently use the chip and pin system do that?
Long story short, they don't. Chip and PIN is something that helps you for what's called card is present type of scams, meaning when the card gets stolen by, you know, a waiter or a point of sale, like a Target, got compromised.
Sure.
But online, you can't. That just doesn't work the same way. I mean, online, you're back to a card not present type of scheme. Now, what I want to say is that typically the breaches of card not present are much, much, much smaller in magnitude than card is present type of problems. Meaning, you know, if your credit card is physically stolen, that's something that happens a lot more often than having your credit card being stolen online.
Okay.
What do you think about the security of systems like Square, Nicholas? Again, that involves a swipe, typically, with a little card reader and the Square software. Do you have any opinions on alternative credit card transactions, Square not being the only one out there?
Well, so right now what Square does, which is pretty smart, is to have essentially a very, very small magnetic stripe reader, which essentially what it does is that it reads off your magnetic stripe and converts that into audio signals that can then be processed by a phone or an iPad. So that's 100% magnetic stripe. But I don't think this is what, you know, Square bases their business on. They base their business on being a novel payment system, and the interface that you're using, whether it's that, you know, small Square thing that you use to scan a magnetic stripe, or if they move to something that, you know, can actually talk to a chip, if we have chips on our cards soon, I don't think that's going to affect them much.
Okay, well, so we're all quaking in our boots about the security of our credit card information. I guess that means we're all going to convert our cash into bitcoins and go that route, right? Isn't that what we're going to do? What do you think, Anupam?
Well, I think people are still going to use credit cards just because they're convenience. And so it's, I'm not sure that the ordinary use of bitcoins is right around the corner. Of course, we could have credit cards based on bitcoins, which might be the next step. I think there's a lot to be done in this area. We are far from being where we need to be. Now, we have to remember that credit cards are not used around the world at the same pace that they are in the United States and in a few other jurisdictions. And credit cards are really such an incredible importance to commerce generally. And so we should make sure that we don't make it impossible to be a credit card provider. And though I think that credit card providers have not been entirely responsible in all this generally thus far.
Nicholas, it's been a bad week for Bitcoin on a couple of fronts. Have you been following both the denial of service attack on the exchanges earlier this week and also Silk Road 2, I guess, came out and admitted that they had been hacked and had lost over 4,000 Bitcoins?
Yeah, and in both cases, it's exactly the same problem. So first of all, this is a problem that's been known since about 2011, and it's actually not something that should be a major problem. Let me try to explain a little bit what's going on. What's going on is an issue called transaction malleability. And rather than going into the cryptographic details, let me give you an analogy with the real world. If I give you a check, on the check, there's going to be my account number, there's going to be your name, and there's going to be a check number and an amount. So when you get this check, you cash it, and I can see, you know, that check number 112 has been cashed. Bitcoin basically works more or less in the same fashion. There's no centralized bank and all of that, but that's actually not really relevant to what we're talking about right now. What the attack is that you cannot change the amount, you cannot change the sender, you cannot change the recipient, but you can actually change the equivalent of the check number. That's called a transaction ID in Bitcoin, which means that if I give you a check, check number 112, you can scratch that off and change it to check 200, for instance. Then you go to the bank, you deposit it. And then what you do is that you tell me, hey, I've never received the check that you sent me. Look at your records. There's nothing about check 112. And I look at my record and I say, ah, yes, indeed. And then you convince me to actually reissue a transaction for the same amount of money, right? So in itself, it's not a problem unless the party who is paying uses only this check number, this transaction ID, as a way of tracking whether or not a transaction has been completed. And that shouldn't happen. People shouldn't be doing that. They should be checking with the sender, with the recipient, and with the amount. And that is unforgeable. So there shouldn't be any problem, except that a lot of implementations of wallets and online Bitcoin systems actually still use the transaction ID. And so that's why we're having a problem right now. And so this is both the denial of service that is happening on those exchanges right now. There's a lot of bogus transactions that are created like that. And as well as what apparently happened on Silk Road 2, somebody ran exactly the scam that I discussed to essentially empty the main escrow, which is more or less the vault of Silk Road, to empty this escrow account and run away with the money. So that's where we are.
Anupam, do you think the international Silk Road of the internet and online transactions is getting a bad name from things like Silk Road and Silk Road 2?
You know, I think it's there was banditry on the ancient Silk Roads. Mm. There's going to be banditry today, and there will be people who use these passages to transfer illegal substances. And so that's the history of humankind. And I don't think that we should say that the internet is particularly more of a cesspool than our ordinary lives are.
Are you surprised that Bitcoin, which seems to appeal to those on the fringes and those kind of on the cutting edge of engaging with technology, that people in that situation seem not only prone to using it, but to hacking it?
You know, hackers are always, the computer enthusiasts always think that they're the best computer enthusiasts. And so, you know, I'm not surprised that people might be surprised that there might be someone better than them in computer security. This is, again, goes back to my concern about Norway setting up its own allegedly secure system. You know, there will always be someone else who comes up with a way to defeat that system. We need to be, we just need to know that security is going to be a persistent problem in cyberspace as elsewhere.
Kevin, are you putting everything into copper, silver, and gold?
I think there's plenty of reasons not to be involved in those as well, but a bit of a scam there in certain exchanges there. Bitcoins, I think they're going to be great for those people that want to use them. And I think, you know, once they work out some of these issues, the transaction ID is the current one, but I'm sure that there'll be, you know, the other issues going forward. I mean, it's a new system, it's a new currency. I think going forward, it's going to be great for people who really want to use it. You know, whether it ever gets mainstream, that's another matter. I sort of doubt I'll be able to ever pay my mortgage in a Bitcoin. For those people that want to use it, I think it's a fine thing.
All right, let's move on to some questions of law and policy and regulation and where it's in order and where it's not. Anupam, you had a very interesting article last fall called How Law Made Silicon Valley, pointing out the differences between how United States law, starting at about the turn of the 21st century, began encouraging commerce and innovation, particularly around the internet, including things like doing away with intermediary liability, under the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, various other provisions that help businesses move ahead in the United States in ways where they might be hampered abroad Do you see any shift taking place there? Do you see other countries starting to emulate us, or is the U.S. still the place you want to be doing business if you're an innovator?
I think the U.S. is still the place you want to be doing business if you're an innovator. I do think that we have to worry about the United States generally. I think there's always reasons for concern and watchfulness. But the central premise of my article is that where the United States approached the internet with hope, the rest of the world approached it with fear. And there's reason for both hope and fear on the internet, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of good things on the internet, and there are a lot of bad things on the internet that we've discussed. But the rest of the world worried more about the costs, the harms that would arise from the internet. And we worried more about the opportunities and the possibilities that it created. So we particularly were concerned and moved by the possibility of improving access to speech. And that undergirded much of our early interventions in favor of these information intermediaries, which, of course, are the new speech platforms of the day. They are the new CBS and the town hall that exists today.
Right. So you give the example that something that might be celebrated in the United States could lead to jail in Japan. Could you give us an example of that?
Sure. And I talk about a programmer in Japan who was essentially came up with a protocol, a P2P file sharing service called Winnie. And instead of being celebrated for being a kind of internet entrepreneur, he was actually charged with criminal offenses. What was his crime? That he continued to allow the downloading of his software, a P2P file sharing service, right? Even after he became, it became known to him that some people were using it for copyright infringement, right? So understand that. So if you know that someone is using your system for copyright infringement, and then you continue selling that system or providing that system, he was giving it away for free, of course, then you are a criminal. Okay. Now, that is a remarkable story. Imagine if we place the same standard for Steve Jobs with respect to iPod, right? We wouldn't have the innovation that we have today if we followed these kinds of rules. And that, in fact, I think is exactly what hampered Japan has had far better internet backbones than the United States for a long time. I took a train in the 1990s to Narita Airport from Tokyo, and the young woman sitting next to me looked like a college student or something. She took her laptop, she took her phone, and she tethered her laptop to her phone and surf the internet. This is at the end of the 1990s. You mm-hmm. still don't see that in the United States today, right? So Japan had all the technology one would want, but its law turned out to be highly risk averse, right? We don't want to have something like P2P because it allows for lots of copyright infringement. But of course, P2P is exactly what I'm using right now to talk to you because I'm using Skype. Right. And so all the innovations that have become possible would not be possible in a world where the law is too worried about the risks and the harms.
So we want to, as much as possible, try and keep the barriers to people innovating down. But at the same time, we need protections against the other things we've been speaking about on the show today, maybe not so much protection for copyright holders, but protection certainly for those possessed of that confidential data that they want to keep confidential and secure. Is there a tension there?
Certainly there's a tension between desire to keep everything secure the desire to use these incredible systems, right, which create such power. You know, I was reluctant to venture into Facebook myself, for example, because of the risks of private information being publicly disclosed. And so I think these are important issues generally for society. But I think if we act in a way that makes the burdens, the liabilities, fall on the intermediaries of speech, then essentially what the speech intermediaries will do will either shut down or they will shut speech down. So those are the two options left to the speech intermediaries for widespread liability. And I think that is exactly what the United States did not do in the 1990s and into the last decade.
Okay, thanks for that. Hey, Nicholas, I wanted to backtrack before we get to our next story on Comcast and Time Warner here in a second. I wanted to follow up on something on the credit card security front that I read you quoted as saying in one of the articles in our show notes today. Those of you viewing and listening can access all that information at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/246. All our links are there. And that is this question, and I think it does go to, since we're on the topic of legislation and policy and regulation right now, it does go to whether government is going to step in and make some decisions about how secure credit card data has to be. The comment that you made had to do with the market getting flooded with credit card data because so much hacking has gone on that we might actually see a diminution of the hacking because it's just not that attractive anymore if there's all this information out there and the price goes down.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's a theory, but it's something that we've seen in the past. A couple of years ago, I think it was around 2010, if you wanted to buy a Visa or a MasterCard online, a fraudulent one, you would have to pay maybe $2 for it. Now, I checked recently how much those were going for, and at least on the one forum that I was checking a few days ago, it was $10 to $20. So those are commodities that are being traded, much like any other commodity. And the fact that they are illegal, the fact that they are fraudulent, doesn't change anything to the basic law of economics of supply and demand. And, you know, the more of those cards are getting compromised, the more of them are being stolen, if you will, the more you're increasing the supply, unless you're very, very careful about not divulging too many of those credit card numbers too quickly. So as soon as you increase supply, unless the demand also increases at the same time, what you're going to see is you're going to see a reduction in the price that you can ask for things. And so it's worth wondering if it's going to remain, you know, a profitable endeavor for people to actually still that many credit cards, if we are very quick, and by we I mean banks, regulators, and so forth, if we are very quick to immediately flag a stolen credit card as bad so that no one can use it. If you go online and purchase that credit card and spend maybe, you know, $10 on something that actually doesn't work, you're unlikely to return as a customer, or if you do return, you're going to ask for the exact same good, but maybe for 10 cents. And so what I'm wondering, and again, it's a hypothesis. I don't know if that's going to be true or not. We need to measure that over, you know, months and years to figure out whether or not these economic dynamics also apply there. But what I do wonder is whether or not we are going to see actually an oversupply of fraudulent credit cards that are actually not very useful to people because they're immediately flagged. And if you use them, well, basically you end up in jail. So that's the main question, right? And if that is the case, then if people cannot sell those credit cards at a high premium, then, you know, they're not making money out of it. And maybe it's more profitable for them to try to break into some computers to sell, you know, computing cycles or anything else that their skills can allow them to do.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating idea. And it's something that regulators should bear in mind, I think, when they're considering how to deal with this problem. Do you know if anyone, you said that there's a good deal of study that would have to take place before we would know if that were in fact happening. Do you know of any scholarship that's going on that issue?
Yeah, there's definitely a number of people that are monitoring the economics of online crime. It's a pretty vibrant research area. Mostly, I would say, coming from computer scientists like myself. That's the community I'm most familiar with. But now we start seeing, you know, economists and even sociologists getting interested in that.
Yeah, I thought it was a fascinating idea. All right, another idea that has been floating around this week is the notion that Comcast would buy Time Warner for $45 billion, $45.2 billion. That seems to be what the companies want to do. There are a couple of legal angles to it, the most obvious one being whether regulators will let this go forward from an antitrust standpoint. And the notion, too, of net neutrality that comes up time and time and again, whether that would be impacted by the consolidation of these two very large cable companies in the United States. Anna Palm, I know this is not necessarily your primary area of study, but when two large telecommunications companies decide to merge and take charge of the information flow to a country like the United States, it's certainly a big deal. Do you think that regulators could or should put a stop to this?
You know, it does worry me when we reduce again and again the number of major information intermediaries that we have, the people who are providing the plumbing to the communications that you and I are engaged in. I use Comcast at home. I go switch back and forth between AT&T and Comcast, basically, find just, you know, essentially where my boiling point with my ISP comes to the point where I have to switch, and then I switch over to AT&T, hoping I might find something else better, but never ever actually being satisfied. So I think we are in internet, our phones, our communications are far more expensive in the United States than they are in many other parts of the world, which have better communications. So I'm really uncomfortable with where we are right now. And unless they have a promise that they will reduce rates by X percent, rather than raise them by 2X, which is the worry, I'm quite skeptical. So I was skeptical when XM and Sirius merged. I use satellite radio. I remain concerned, quite concerned here.
Well, the price, the rate piece seems to be something that Comcast is floating out there to try and dodge under the FCC stepping in and doing any kind of antitrust regulating here, because apparently Comcast has an access program that provides need-based reduced rates that would then be extended out to the Time Warner customers as well. And they're holding that up as a good thing. This is in keeping with your goals, FCC, of increasing access. And they've also promised on the net neutrality front that the representation they made that Comcast will abide by the now defunct open internet order for an undetermined period of time would apply to Time Warner as well if they were to take it over. Does any of that give you any more assurance about this idea?
I'm skeptical entirely. Providing a lower cost service may well just be a profit maximizing move. It may be a way to segment your market so that you can extract the most rents from both sides. Essentially, if you are providing, typically when you're providing a service, you would like ideally to price discriminate among your richer, more desirous customers and your poorer customers when the kind of marginal cost of production is below what even the poor person might be willing to pay. And that may well be the case here. So I'm not sure that having Time Warner adopt the strategy as well, or that Time Warner is such a kind of benevolent act. It may just be something that Time Warner does eventually on its own, regardless, just as a profit maximizing move.
Kevin, what do you think about all this?
I'm sort of of one mind with Anupam on a lot of this. I'm sort of glad I'm not a Comcast customer currently. I'm not a Time Warner customer either. I'm very happy in that regard. But net neutrality has been an issue that's been forefront for me and, for some of our clients. And it certainly is something that I'm concerned about. Just the fact that they give lip service to it in, these announcements, I think, shows how important of an issue it is. We'll have to see, the net neutrality guidelines, should, come out to be, down the road. But for right now, it's just sort of a trust and a handshake, between some of these companies. Having less players involved is a problem. I know that, when Netflix posts this list of the ISPs that have the worst rates on there for data on its own and it's streaming, the Netflix says that, Comcast is always the lowest of the people on their list. And I don't see, that type of service improving. The Comcast claims that they don't throttle Netflix, but, something is causing them to be a lot slower than all the other ISPs.
Right.
And
something's going to give somewhere, if Comcast and Time Warner do merge this way and control so much of the U.S. market, and they don't reduce rates, it doesn't seem like they're coming out and saying, well, that's what we'll do in order to accommodate this, much as Anupam might think that might be a good idea, then they're going to find a large number of people trying to route around, cord cut, get their entertainment without having to go through a cable company. But in order to do that, they're still going to have to go through an internet company. And
right.
there's the rub.
So can I just talk about the price issue?
Yes.
It's not unheard of for a company to say when it wants something positive from a regulator that we mm-hmm. will reduce our prices in the future. I worked in a privatization in the Philippines, where it was the water company that was being privatized. And of course, anytime you're going to privatize some big utility like that, the biggest worry is going to be the private entity is going to now come in and raise your rates and really, because there's only one option basically to get water. But what they did, the way we ran this privatization was we said, what is the discount on the current rate that you will offer, right? And we said we also had benchmarks as to how much they had to expand coverage of water services. So I think, if I suspect that there are huge economies of scale here, but I think they should be saying essentially we will make consumer lives better, and we promise to do that for the next 20 years. Our rates will be, kept, will be lower than they are now, because you will share in the benefits of the economies of scale that we're receiving.
God, I hope so, because the rates are just so through the roof. I mean, I don't know how the average American wage earner even affords cable TV. Basic cable TV is over $100 a month, at least where we live. And it just cracks me up and makes me cringe every time you hear one of the ads that the cable company, whichever one it is, puts on talking about how, something is free for you, the viewer. Nothing is free. You're paying through the nose for your service, and whatever it is they're providing you, you're certainly compensating them for. Nicholas, do you have any thoughts or opinions about this merger?
On this merger itself, I think that the points that were raised before were interesting. I think that I started to have some doubts and a little bit of unease when we had cable service providers like Comcast started to merge with actual internet service providers like AT&T and with content providers getting their feeds from NBC and things like that. And I think that so far, I mean, prices is a different thing, but in terms of the issue of control, we've been so far okay, even though there was a great deal of anxiety when those previous deals occurred. But, you know, you've got to wonder if we're at the tipping point or not. I mean, it's now so concentrated that we are definitely perhaps not yet in a monopoly situation, but we are getting closer and closer to a very small oligopoly. And that's always, you know, worrisome.
All right. Well, let's move on from information being provided to us at varying speeds by cable companies to information that is residing in and being used by Facebook. And that has to do with the social web.
So, Denise, I need to go in a couple minutes.
Sure. That's Anupam. You need to depart and leave us shortly.
Yes. It's Valentine's Day and I have lunch with my wife.
Oh, good for you. Yes, this is truly This Week in Love, then. We can let you go whenever you'd like. We can let you go now if you need to. We'll
You know, I will. I will. I'm going to leave this in the very capable hands of Kevin and Nicholas and, of course, your hands. Yes. I do, just with respect to Facebook, I should just put in a plug. There's a whole chapter called Facebookistan in my book, The Electronic Silk Road. The book is $19 on Amazon, so it's pretty cheap. For a law text that's actually quite serious. And so I hope that yes. People will buy it.
And your book, we're doing it early since you need to leave us. Your book is one of our resources of the week this week. So we will encourage people to go out and check it out. And thanks so much for joining us today and for all your thoughts and insights. We hope you have a lovely lunch with your wife.
Thank you. Thanks, Denise. It was great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, so on the Facebook front, Anupam was saying that he doesn't even put his data in there. I know others of us have been far too eager to put our data in, and others are waiting in the wings, you know, as young people are growing up, whether or not you buy into the arguments that Facebook is no longer relevant to young people. I think there is still some sort of appeal there. And certainly the fact that they're not able to access it until they're 13 years old makes it into this sort of mysterious thing that they at least want to try out. There has been a settlement that we have discussed on the show before in the Fraley versus Facebook class action that had to do with sponsored stories and using people's name and likeness in promotional bits on Facebook without their express consent. That was what the lawsuit alleged. It settled. Facebook never admitted liability there, and I think would have put forward arguments that its terms of service covered it for what it was engaged in. But rather than have a large and public trial, Facebook did settle the case, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has approved the settlement. And so all appeared to be moving along as planned, and shortly, you know, your $10 or $15 may be coming your way if you were a Facebook user who was impacted by sponsored stories at all. A last ditch flag has been thrown on the play by some public interest groups, including Public Citizen and others. They would very much like the settlement overturned because of the minor piece. The fact that going forward, Facebook intends to cover this issue in its terms of service by having minors state, represent to Facebook that their parents have authorized them the use of their name and likeness for advertising by Facebook without any express consent from the parents. Now, this is something that Facebook has to worry about, getting consent from minors, because even though Facebook is entitled to gather information from those under the age of 18 and over the age of 13 under the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, it is not entitled to make use of that information without express parental consent. So this whole notion that you could have a child saying, oh, my mom says this is okay, my mom and dad say this is okay, is giving a huge amount of pause to these public citizen groups. And they are, they filed a brief with the Ninth Circuit asking that the settlement be set aside and other amicus briefs are being filed in support. I'm not sure how optimistic I am that anything will happen with this, but it's an interesting point, this notion that the terms of service going forward has this clause that kids are representing that parents approve. Several states expressly have laws against gathering consent in that way. So, Kevin, what do you think about this sort of a late in the game Hail Mary that's going on here? Do you think it has any chance of success?
I'm curious to, see what the other amicus briefs that are filed on this, take the position they take, whether or not they truly support this argument. I think it's certainly a concern, especially since there are some states that explicitly prohibit this type of consent. I know personally, within our family, we're sort of struggling with this issue. My oldest son is now 13, and he has asked more than once, when can he, start a Facebook account? So, we're sort of struggling, with that issue ourselves. Do we consent or do we not, to even having a page in the first place, much less whether or not we're going to consent to his use of, his image in advertising. We'll have to see how that all plays out. That aside, I think they do make a very good point, that it does violate the law in those states. And, I'm curious as to, what the Ninth Circuit does with that.
Yep. It sure will be interesting to watch. We're talking about two different legal problems that your family is facing, Kevin. Your 13-year-old, if they want to, you have your own laws within your family, obviously. But as far as laws that impact Facebook go, Facebook is okay if they let your 13-year-old sign up. It's just a question of what sort of consent to use of their data they have to obtain if they're going to make use of them in ways such as Sponsored Stories does. Nicholas, do you have any thoughts or want to weigh in on Facebook and kids at all?
Well, I mean, here it's really more of a legal problem than a technological problem. I mean, the issue of consent, of license agreement, that actually, I have to say, that completely falls outside my area of expertise. I've got opinions, but, they're not professional opinions.
Gotcha. We'll let you off the hook on that one. Let's move on to our tips. Actually, let's do one copyright story before we move on to our tips and resources of the week. Kevin mentioned we have everything from the NSA to Flappy Bird in the show today. I don't know how we can't talk about Flappy Bird, at least briefly, because there is a little legal gloss on this. There's no sort of proof of this at all, and Nintendo is just calling it rumor. But just to bring people up to speed, if you're not aware of what Flappy Bird is, it is a game developed by a gentleman in Vietnam that was quite popular, was bringing him some $50,000 a day in ad revenue. I'm sad to say that I did not get on this quickly enough to download it before it was no longer available, but it is no longer available now. Its founder says that this has nothing to do with legal issues, but some of his colleagues or acquaintances or friends told Reuters that, in fact, he had been contacted by Nintendo because of a resemblance between the game and Mario Brothers. So Nintendo says, no, that's just rumor. We're not confirming anything. But there, it could well be that the sad passing of Flappy Bird, which has had several people wringing their hands during this week did have some sort of legal aspect to it. Kevin, were you able to get in on it before it was gone?
Yeah, my oldest son actually, about 2 days before the announcement was made, asked me if we could download Flappy Bird. So we hopped on the bandwagon then, and then I had to tell him, by the way, you know, your timing was great, because about 2 days later was when he made his announcement. Personally, I can't say I've had a chance to play it yet, but you know, I think his comment was it is indeed sort of a frustrating but addicting game to play. So I can see why. You know, if you read the author's you know, statements on it, you know, it was the fact it was just simply too addictive of a game, and you know, just not something he wanted to be associated with going forward. But from a legal standpoint, you know, I mean, I've thought about this a little bit. The bird flaps along. You know, the background is these pipes, which look oddly enough like the pipes from the Mario Brothers games. And you know,
do they go into the pipes? And are there mushrooms?
Not as far as I am aware of. I don't think they go into them at all, and I don't think there's mushrooms. I think they're just an obstacle to avoid. I think if you hit the pipe, you know, you fail. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the issue there. And I'm not so sure. I think some of them, maybe the gusts of wind and things like that come out, but I'm not really sure on that particular point. But that being said, it's more of an homage to Mario Brothers, and you know, whether Nintendo, you know, would really have a cognizable copyright claim on just merely the pipes. You know, it's more of a functional aspect of the Mario Brothers game. As opposed to like a real, truly original expression, you know, perhaps the color of the pipes, you know, because they're that odd green color that you find only in the Mario Brothers games. You don't really find too many, you know, real pipes that are that shade. You know, so I think, you know, perhaps that might, you know, nudge it a little bit more towards creative expression. But Nintendo has, you know, said publicly that they didn't send any such thing, or at the very least that they can't confirm or deny that anything, you know, was ever sent. And it's sort of an interesting question, but ultimately, you know, would this be the reason to take it down? You know, I'm sort of skeptical on that.
Over in IRC, we've got a great comment here. Oh, I just lost track of it. Where is it? I forget who said it, but here we go. It's Synac. I bought Flappy Bird with Bitcoin only to find out it was an NSA backdoor. So that pretty much sums up the whole show today. But yeah, it does seem like an interesting legal issue that we'll never actually see resolved because the game's not available, and I doubt Nintendo would take any action based on what had happened to date. But yes, the question of the copyrightability of the green pipe, I guess, will have to be shelved for another day. Or I suppose there could be trademark ramifications as well. You know, there are certain aspects of Mario Brothers that I'm certain Nintendo has trademarked too. I don't know if green pipes would be among them so as some sort of logo or symbol of the game.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this might arise to the same level of like color marks, you know, like the pink, yeah, pixelation or something like that? I don't
something
know if it really
like that,
would reach
yeah,
that level of consumer awareness, but certainly among the geek community, you know, you see green pipes, you think Mario Brothers. So, you know, it's totally got niche fame.
Yeah. Nicholas, thoughts?
Well, I wonder, you know, if the guy took it down because of the threat of legal action, or simply took it down because he was uncomfortable with being the center of attention that he has been. I mean, this is a guy who went from being completely unknown to making $50,000 a day in a country mm-hmm. where $50,000 is actually more like $5 million for us.
Right.
So, you know, you may end up being yourself the target of some attention that you don't necessarily want.
Yep. Excellent points. Let's make Flappy Bird our second, as an homage to the parting of Flappy Bird, our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We have some tips and resources for you. Actually, just one tip, and it has to do with trademark law. And another story that was much in the news all week, quite a nice trademark stunt that's been playing out in my neck of the woods in Southern California, the dumb Starbucks story. Lisa Brodkin was just on the show with us. And she has a great article, my favorite coverage of this by far, in The Guardian, where she basically sums up what happened. Dumb Starbucks opened in a mysterious kind of way, using all of the Starbucks logos, but putting dumb in front of everything, right down to the music CDs that were available for sale. It turns out to have been a publicity stunt by Nathan, I'm forgetting his last name, Nathan Fielder, who has a funny show on Comedy Central where he's giving out bad business advice. Certainly using Starbucks trademarks without authorization would fall into that category. And it had this whole kind of performance art thing going on where he made it, if this is indeed a legally okay parody, he has some, I think, strong claims to that. Fortunately, it doesn't seem like that's ever going to be litigated. As Lisa points out in her article, Starbucks did not pull the trigger and sue. They did issue some statements that were pretty smart all around that, of course, no one, they sort of took the whole likelihood of confusion part of trademark off the table by saying they didn't think that people were actually confused about the fact that this was could have been a real Starbucks or not. But they did, you know, say we're not making any decisions at this time. We're not going to take legal action right now, but we're not ruling that out. And they did not fall prey to jumping on this and giving it even more publicity than it already got during the week. So our tip of the week on this is it's smart to take a wait and see kind of approach, as Starbucks did when you see a very high profile and flagrant use of your trademark in the marketplace. It turns out strategically, I think, you know, it'd be hard to argue that Starbucks did anything but the right thing here. And our friend Marty Schwimmer, who is our resident trademark specialist who comes on 12 from time to time, tweeted this morning an adjunct to our tip, a fairly useful maxim: lawful parodies remind you, they don't deceive you. And it seems like that's what was going on here. Just to add a couple more tips to our tip, I really enjoyed Lisa's article too, because not just of the substance of it, but the fact that she reminds folks in the article that she was at one time a Starbucks lawyer. So she gets that disclaimer out in the actual text. And then at the end has great disclaimers, that further disclaimers that she's the shareholder of 4 shares of Starbucks Corporation and a gold level Starbucks card holder. So, you know, all of her biases are on the table there. Let's move on to our resource of the week. We mentioned one, and that is the Electronic Silk Road, the wonderful book by Anupam Chander. Go check that out if you have not. It talks about binding the world together in commerce via the World Wide Web, and is a fascinating look at the way the internet functions internationally and the way that policy and regulation can impact that function. Also, just for fun, in honor of This Week in Love this week, we threw in, again, you can pull this up at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/246. The hidden traps, the hidden legal traps of Valentine's Day is an article with a great graphic that I believe you're seeing now if you're watching the show, of poor Cupid biting the dust on his own arrow, no less, of the various hazards in the workplace brought about by Valentine's Day, and how, while it's fun to give Valentines, you definitely need to be careful. There's some statistics in this article that lay out why. Be careful. It says 31% of those workers surveyed said they received a Valentine's Day themed gift from a coworker, including balloons, flowers, candy, singing telegrams, etc. But this article points out that if you are a coworker, perhaps the person sending that romantic item shouldn't be you. This can not only get you in trouble with your coworkers, but in your personal life as well, if you're showering your coworkers with gifts that perhaps your significant other might not approve of. So happy Valentine's Day, everyone. It has been fun to spend it with you, and we hope that you make safe and sane decisions in your celebrating the holiday today. Nicholas, it's been so fun chatting with you. Let us know if there's anything coming up that our viewers and listeners might be interested in knowing about, whether it's something you're working on, a talk at Carnegie Mellon, just anything at all that might be of interest that we haven't touched on yet.
Not at this moment, but I certainly will let you know in the future. And thank you again Sure. for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We really appreciate your coming on and helping us understand all of the hacking that's been going on lately and get a better perspective on that. Kevin, always great to have you back on the show.
Well, it's always great to be here. Thanks again for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Anything going on with you that you want to let people know about?
I was just thinking about that when you asked Nicholas. I mean, I don't think I've got anything major. I am going to be speaking at ABA Tech Show coming up at the end of March on cloud computing and you know, some of the risks of that from a legal standpoint. You know, but that's a lawyer conference, and certainly you know, if there's any you know, listeners from the show that are also at the conference, don't be afraid to look me up and say hello.
All right. Thanks so much, Kevin and Nicholas. Thank you so much, Annapom, for joining us, although you have departed and are already celebrating your Valentine's Day. Once you get done with your celebrating, you may be wondering, where can I get more of this thing called This Week in Law? If you head on over to twit.tv/twill, you'll find our whole archive of shows there. We're also on YouTube at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We record the show live every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC, and we'd love it when you join us live. You can just go to twit.tv and it will be what's live on the stream at that time. So whether you're joining us on your own time or with us live, we greatly appreciate your participating in the show. We could not do the show without the great suggestions and comments and fun that we have going back and forth with you folks who tune in each week or as often as you can. So we're so glad that you do. Please let us know what's on your mind about the show. You can email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Co-host Evan, who couldn't be here this week, but will be back next week. In fact, I will be out next week. So Kevin, or not Evan, I mean, will be, Kevin won't be here. Evan will next week hosting the show while I'm out of town. So look for him and email him at evan@twit.tv. He's Internet Cases on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. And you should find us on Facebook if you've been brave enough to consign your data to that medium. Also on Google Plus too, we've got a community and page over there if you have more information to get us in more of a public forum. We love hearing from you about what we've discussed on the show, what you think we should discuss on the show, guests you think would be great to complement the topics that we cover. All of that is very, very welcome. So keep it coming and have a really wonderful Valentine's weekend, everyone. We'll see you next week.